The story you are about to hear is true.
Attention, all true.
She's alive. Alive!
Welcome to the Retroist.
My obsession with Hawaii started when I was a kid, thanks to TV shows like The Brady Bunch and Magnum P.I. Magnum's adventures and The Brady's trip made Hawaii seem like a distant paradise. I knew one day, when I grew up, that I would go there. And so, years later, as an adult, but with what I would like to think is the same childlike enthusiasm for Hawaii, I went to visit. And I didn't know if I was ever going to go back, so I wanted this to be a special experience and to do all the touristy things I dreamed about. So of course I got a convertible and I planned on going hiking and snorkeling, swimming, anything that said I'm on vacation in Hawaii. And my first day there started like something out of a brochure. I drove to this sacred valley, the car top down, wind blowing through my hair. I parked the car, my camera, which was in my bag, was on the floor in the back seat, and I reached down to get it, and to my horror, I found that the bag was swarming with shiny black ants, crawling all over the bag. And what was weirder is that there were these tiny white specks that it turns out were ant eggs, also all over the place. A whole colony of future generations were taking a ride in my rental car. Or when I started thinking about it, maybe I had it backwards and I was driving around in their home. This wasn't part of the itinerary, and I kind of had this frenzied moment of trying to get the ants out of the car. I shook out my bag, and I tried my best with what I had to scoop out as many ants as I could. I was, by the end of it, red and sweating and upset, but I thought, I got these guys out of there. Now I can begin my vacation. 2 days later, I went for an evening hike on this volcano, which it turns out is normal in Hawaii. And on the way back, I started to feel this itching on my legs and thought, oh, there must have been something out here that bit me while I was on this hike. I got back in the car and I'm driving back. It's beautiful. I get to see a moonbow over the sky. It's a night rainbow. It's amazing. And I reach down to scratch one of my itches, and I find not just my leg, but an ant on my leg. I pushed it off and thought, oh, there must be some lingering ants in there. But it was very dark, and so I continued to drive. I think I was probably distracted by that moonbow, not thinking what this meant. But I went back to the hotel to rest, and I don't know what it was, maybe the after effects of ant venom coursing through my system, but I had terrible nightmares that I would almost describe as hallucinations, bizarre imagery, a very rough night. The next morning, I got up feeling a little bit better, but what was ahead of me really excited me. It was a trip to a bakery. So I put last night behind me, hopped in the car, and started driving. I look down on my legs, and there are ants climbing on my legs again. I panicked and pulled over into a gas station, got out of the car, and started moving around, getting the ants off of me. This, of course, was fascinating to the people who were at the gas station. And so I went into the gas station and asked them if they had something that could kill ants. The guy who owned the gas station seemed interested in this, and he came out to look at the car. And he had never seen anything like this before. And now, I had not taken the deep look I should have probably days ago. But at this point, I lifted more of the mats, I started moving the seat up, and turns out there were just ants everywhere. This was surprising even to the guy who owned the gas station. He went in, got me some ant spray, and said, "It's all yours." And I started spraying everywhere. But I soon realized I couldn't get them all. They were just everywhere, and I needed to return this car. So, smelling of ant spray, my legs covered in ant welts, and probably a good amount of ant venom still coursing through my bloodstream, I raced to the car rental return, and I was upset. When I got there and explained, they offered to exchange the car, and I said, "Well, why are there ants in it? How could this be? Is this other one gonna have ants?" And the person said, "Well, you know, it's Hawaii, so maybe." The rest of my vacation was pretty drama-free, but the entire time I was balancing my idea of this idealized Hawaii with the more unpredictable realities. And it makes me think of the dual nature of paradise. You have this breathtaking beauty, and yet it can, just like anywhere else, throw the unexpected at you. Thinking back to my childhood and the shows I loved, my experience isn't too far from the Brady Bunch, or more accurately, Magnum P.I. This was a wondrous area to be in, but it was fraught with unforeseen challenges. And so, embracing the that's just Hawaii mindset, I decided I'm going to let that go and just focus on all the wonderful things that this state had to offer. And as I sat on my final day on this volcanic rock, letting the ocean waves gently soothe my ant-bitten legs, I realized paradise has its pitfalls. Every dream, its unexpected turns, and Hawaii with all its natural splendor is no exception. It was a place of contrasts where you could have the beauty of a moonbow coexisting at the same time as a colony of ants living in your car. So on today's show, I'd like to talk to you about one of the shows that inspired my trip to Hawaii, Magnum P.I. We'll talk about the people in front of and behind the camera. We'll talk about the show's history, reception, and we'll throw in a few surprises here and there. We have an info-packed episode ahead of us, so without further ado, let's start the show. There has been a long tradition of TV shows set in Hawaii. Most notably before Magnum P.I. was probably Hawaii Five-0, which ran from 1968 to 1980. And one of the reasons Magnum P.I. was set in Hawaii was for that very reason. CBS didn't want to close its Hawaiian production offices after Hawaii Five-0 had closed. So after Hawaii Five-0, two people stepped up to powerhouses of television, Don Belisario and Glenn A. Larson, to create a new show that would be called Magnum P.I., and there would be substantial pressure on them to have the show set in Hawaii. It's not clear exactly which came first, Hawaii or Magnum, but it does seem that the show was created around the idea of being in Hawaii, and that is why CBS chose it. Either way, I like to think of it as carrying the torch of Hawaii Five-0 to a different generation. In fact, during the early seasons of Magnum P.I., there's actually references to Hawaii Five-0, and they mention Steve McGarrett. Of course, he never makes an appearance on the show, but I do believe there was an attempt to try to pull the two together, and I think that would have been great. But I'm going to assume they live in the same universe. So one could say Magnum P.I., although itself a television classic, is sort of a spin-off of Hawaii Five-0 just because of the references. Although, just to have anyone from Hawaii Five-0 appear in character on Magnum would have really cemented this, and plus, what a great Easter egg that would have been. Just a little bit about Don Belisario and Glenn A. Larson, because they played a huge part in my childhood television watching. Don Belisario was born in 1935. He would work as a creator or even just a writer on many shows that I loved, including Kojak, Baba Black Sheep, Battlestar Galactica, Magnum P.I., Tales of the Gold Monkey, Airwolf, Quantum Leap. The list just goes on and on. The other person who helped create this show was Glenn A. Larson. Larson was born in 1937. He passed away in 2014. He worked on a lot of great shows as well. Quincy, Magnum, Knight Rider, The Fall Guy, Sheriff Lobo, Battlestar Galactica, Buck Rogers. Unlike Belisario, there is some criticism around Larson, and mostly in the idea that he does knockoffs of other things. And I wanted to bring this up mostly because and I think I've referenced this on other episodes, the writer Harlan Ellison once referred to him as Glenn Larceny because of the similarities between what Larson puts out there and movies that they're sort of based on. And I think the perfect example of that would be Battlestar Galactica and people pointing to Star Wars. Are you a fan of the Retros Podcast? Do you like more retro stuff? Why not check out the Retros Patreon? Go to patreon.com/retroist. Supporters of the show get bonus episodes, bonus tracks, bonus scans, access to the Retroist Discord, and more. Feel good about yourself and make a difference in the world. Support the Retroist. The show revolves around the adventures of Thomas Sullivan Magnum, who is played very ably by Tom Selleck in what would be his breakthrough role. Magnum is a Vietnam vet who lives in a posh 200-acre beachfront estate that's known as the Robin's Nest, which is named after its owner, Robin Masters, who is a famous author. The estate is in Hawaii, and the actual estate that it was based on was called the Anderson Estate, which is on the east shore of Oahu. It was built in the 30s, and it has a large main house and a boathouse, which is where you see Magnum living all the time. Although the actual interiors weren't often used, mostly it was used for exterior scenes. Virtually all of the indoor shooting was filmed in the studio, the one that I said CBS wanted to keep open. The Anderson Estate has been used in other shows as well. It was, of course, used in Hawaii Five-O, MacGyver, Murder, She Wrote. It's one of those things where you see a show that's filmed in Hawaii, you find yourself looking for when the Anderson Estate is going to show up. Magnum lives at the estate as the security consultant because he has done some favors for its owner, Robin, who we never see. They actually wanted to bring Robin Masters into the show, and they planned to have Orson Welles play the role. He does the voice in a couple of episodes, but he passed away before they were able to do that episode. Later on, this would lead to these convoluted explanations and storylines about who is Robin Masters. Mostly trying to say that the major domo of the house, Higgins, who we'll talk about in a second, was in fact the whole time Robin Masters. Something I don't buy at all. It doesn't make any sense when you look at the whole series. If they had done that from the beginning, with that being the intent, that would have been a really interesting twist as the show went on, but it just doesn't add up. So as I said, Magnum doesn't live there alone. He lives there with Jonathan Quayle Higgins. Jonathan and Thomas have something in common. They're both former military men. Higgins, though, is British, Magnum American, and Higgins is a bit more old school and a bit stodgy. Higgins has two Doberman Pinschers, who he has trained very well, Zeus and Apollo. Now, there's a sort of give and take between Magnum and Higgins. Higgins is in charge of the estate, and he holds the amenities that the estate has above Magnum, kind of keeps them at arm's length to get Magnum to be more pliable to do his bidding. Although Magnum is constantly rebelling against that. And you get this impression that Higgins actually wants him to rebel in some episodes, where he's kind of sad when Magnum isn't the lovable scamp that annoys him so much. If anyone could pull off this whole idea that he was Robin Masters the entire time, it maybe could have been Higgins. Higgins is a very complicated character with a background that's almost like Forrest Gump. He's just been in so many things. And I can almost see him not being Robin Masters, but sort of hinting that he could be just to mess with Magnum in the same way that Magnum messes with him. The overarching story of Magnum P.I. is interesting. You see Magnum as this playboy, and he lives in this estate, living a dream lifestyle, and hanging out with his war buddies, drinking beer, running on the beach, having this adventurous career as a private eye, living a really great life. He talks about paradise all the time and how he's a part of it. But when it comes to his job, he takes it very seriously. And you see this in many episodes. When anybody ever tries to shorthand even the term private investigator to PI, he corrects them. And that adds complexity to the show that could be oversimplified. And I think people who are not watching the show might view it as such. But the writers and creators continue to layer Magnum as time goes on, as we start to learn more about Magnum over the years. We find out that his backstory includes a Navy career, and he was a SEAL. He grew up in Tidewater, Virginia, but was originally from Detroit, which is why he's wearing the Detroit Tigers hat. We learn that his father was a pilot who was killed during the Korean War, and that Magnum's military specialty was counterinsurgency. This included 3 tours of service in Vietnam. He would leave the Navy after becoming disillusioned with the war. And over the course of the show, we would see flashbacks of his time in Vietnam. And like for many people, we would learn it wasn't really that great for him. Although he did meet some great people, including his two best buddies, Theodore T.C. Calvin and Rick Wright, who both live in Hawaii as well. TC is a helicopter pilot who operates a tourist charter business called Island Hoppers, and Rick Wright is the manager of the King Kamehameha Club, which in the pilot is referred to as Rick's Cafe American, which is a reference to Casablanca. Rick was actually a weapons expert and the door gunner for TC's helicopter in Vietnam. Now, since everyone in this show was involved with the military or fought in some war, there's a lot of episodes that allude to war. Have you ever wondered what episodes of Magnum P.I. you should check out? Here's Metagirl with the top 5 episodes of Magnum P.I.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Greetings, retro fans. This is Metagirl bringing you the top 5 episodes from the television series Magnum P.I. At number 5 is Season 1, Episode 7, Never Again, Never Again. When Saul and Lena, an aging couple who run a local shop, abruptly make plans to leave town, suspicious Magnum and Rick, who are friends with the couple, investigate, only to arrive at the couple's home to see Saul whisked away in an ambulance after suffering a heart attack. Yet when they check at the hospital, he's not there. It becomes apparent that Saul has been kidnapped. Number 4 is Season 4, Episode 4, Distant Relative. Under protest, Magnum agrees to chaperone Rick's visiting 22-year-old sister Wendy while Rick works at the club, and quickly discovers that she's not the convent school innocent her brother thinks she is. At number 3 is Season 5, Episode 5, Underworld. As he's about to take off in his helicopter after delivering a pair of newlyweds to Maui, TC is offered a lot of money to deliver a briefcase to Oahu. On his approach to the Island Hoppers headquarters, he loses control of his helicopter and crashes into the ocean. At number 2 is Season 6, Episode 10, Blood and Honor. Magnum is called back to naval service by Admiral Hawks, who has reason to suspect that there is a security leak at his naval base that is leaking coded information. But Hawks can't ask any of his own personnel to investigate, for any one of them could be the mole behind the breach. And the number 1 episode of Magnum P.I. is Season 5, Episode 1, Echoes of the Mind. Magnum is hired by Diane Dupree, who was kidnapped as a child with her twin sister and who now believes that someone is trying to kill her. And there you have it, the Retroist's top 5 episodes of Magnum P.I. Until next time, List fans, this has been Metagirl.
Thanks, Metagirl. The show had a great cast, starting with the breakout star of the show, Tom Selleck, who played the aptly named Thomas Magnum. Selleck's first appearance on television was actually when he was a college senior, when he appeared on The Dating Game. Sadly, he lost both times. He did modeling and then would get into acting, did a bunch of small roles on TV and a few even smaller movies. Eventually, he landed a recurring role as Lance White on The Rockford Files. Then after a few years, Magnum P.I. would come along, and that seemed amazing. But at the same time, Tom Selleck would get cast in a pretty big film, and that movie was Raiders of the Lost Ark. And we know now that this is a career-changing thing to be Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that would have been Tom Selleck. But the producers of Magnum P.I. would not release Tom Selleck to do the movie, and after much debating as to what the right thing to do would be, Selleck decided he had already signed the contract with the Magnum P.I. people a while ago, and that's what he needed to do. Sadly, the filming of the pilot of Magnum P.I. was delayed 6 months, which would have allowed Selleck to do both Magnum and Raiders at the same time. They even filmed part of Raiders in Hawaii. It's just a big what if. In the final season of Magnum, they would do this jokey episode of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's maybe not the best episode, but it's fun to see Tom Selleck dressed up as Indiana Jones using a whip. Just a bunch of silliness. So Tom Selleck would be Magnum P.I., and it's a missed opportunity for him, and he's talked about it many times, and I'm sure it's something that haunts him greatly. Of course, the role of Indiana Jones would go to the consolation prize winner Harrison Ford, and I think we all kind of heard of him at this point. T.C. Calvin was played by Roger E. Moseley. Mosley had a couple of small roles beforehand. Most notably, he played the title character in the 1976 film Lead Belly, which was directed by Gordon Parks. He would appear on shows like Starsky and Hutch, Kojak, and Beretta, and had a role in Roots: The Next Generation. But I think he's probably most famous for his role on Magnum. Larry Minetti would play Orville Wilbur Richard Rick Wright. That is a mouthful. Minetti's first role would be as a young detective in the Jack Webb TV show Chase in 1973. He would then go on to play Bobby Boyle on Baa Baa Black Sheep with Robert Conrad. He then went on to play a bookie in the short-lived NBC series The Duke in 1979. Luckily, the Duke didn't last long, because Minetti would land the role of Rick the very next year. After that, he would get other roles over the years, things like Tales from the Dark Side, Battlestar Galactica, Renegade, Quantum Leap, Walker, Texas Ranger. Minetti wrote a book called Aloha Magnum, which was built around stories from his time on the set, and is filled with anecdotes, stories about the cast and guests, and recipes. So, if you want to learn to cook like Larry Minetti, check out Aloha Magnum. John Hillerman would play Jonathan Quayle Higgins. He's had quite a career, a little bit older than the other cast members. He was mostly a theater actor, and then would start landing minor roles in major motion pictures. Solid character actor. He was in The Last Picture Show, What's Up Doc, Paper Moon, but probably the thing most people at the time are going to recognize him for was his turn in Blazing Saddles. After that, though, and the thing most modern audiences are going to know him for, is his work on Magnum P.I. It's interesting to hear Hillerman speak in real life when he's not doing a British accent, because he is not from the UK. He is from Texas, which is fun when he's doing a Texas accent on the show. He's playing a British person trying to do a Texas accent, and it is very fun to watch Hillerman do that. I've often wondered how good the accent work is on this character, and I've heard stories told online about people who did start watching the show in the UK and were convinced that Hillerman was British. So I guess he does a decent job of it. As a character who's very honorable and takes his responsibilities seriously, I think he represents that area of the world pretty well. Now, there is another star of the show who I feel like I need to give a quick mention, and that is the Ferrari 308 GTB, which you always saw Magnum driving in the show. They would use multiple Ferraris while shooting the show. In the season one, they had a Ferrari 308 GTS. In 81, for seasons 2 through 6, they had a Ferrari 308 GTSI. And then in seasons 7 and 8, a Ferrari 308 GTS Quattro Vivoli. Now, this iconic red car didn't actually belong to Magnum. Instead, it belonged to Robin Masters, and he was just borrowing it. And there were other cars available to use in the show, and they all had license plates with Robin's name on them. So Robin 1, Robin 2, Robin 3. Robin 2 was, for most episodes, an Audi 5000, although in one episode it was a 1974 Jaguar XJ. The Robin 3 was a rugged vehicle. In seasons 1 through 3, it was a 1980 GMC Jimny. In seasons 4 through 6, it was a 1983 Chevy S10 Blazer. And then seasons 7 and 8, it was a 1984 Jeep Cherokee. And when I think about Magnum, I think of the Hawaiian shirts, the mustache, but it really was that red Ferrari that often made him stand out. And it became a part of the show where people would comment on the fact that maybe that wasn't his car. It must belong to somebody else. A guy like him couldn't own a car like that, which, of course, made Magnum very unhappy.
The martial arts.
Hi-ya! Hi-ya! Hi-ya!
I'm often called upon to use them in defense of my Mauna Loa macadamias. You see, Mauna Loa macadamia nuts are so delicately crunchy, so subtly exotic, so irresistible.
Hiya.
They're almost too good to share. Then again, a true karate master never has to prove it.
Mauna Loa macadamias from Hawaii. Share some tonight.
They also had some great recurring characters that helped to flesh out the Magnum universe. Some of the memorable ones are Lieutenant Yoshi Tanaka, the homicide detective played by Kwon Hee Lim. Kind of Columbo-esque character, humorous. He was also a Detroit Tigers fan like Magnum. Next would be Agatha Chumley, one of my favorite side characters. She's really grown on me over the years. She obviously has a crush on Higgins, and that is played very humorously, and I always hope they end up together eventually. Agatha Chumley was played by Gillian Dobb. Carol Baldwin, the assistant district attorney, was played by Patty McCormick in season 1 and Kathleen Lloyd in seasons 3 through 8. Colonel Buck Green, played by Lance LeGault, who was often Magnum's nemesis on the show. Doc Eibold, who was the doctor that everybody used for everything, played by Glenn Cannon. Francis Icepick Hofstetler, who was some sort of crime boss, maybe, but certainly a father figure for Rick. He was originally played by Walter Chotson, and then, more famously, by Elisha Cook Jr. And finally, Mac Reynolds. Mac was played by Jeff McKay, buddy of Magnum. Magnum takes advantage of him to get him to do him favors and is killed. We then get to see the ghost of Mac in some episodes. Now, Jeff had gone on to go do a different show. That show, Tales of the Gold Monkey, failed. He comes back inexplicably as a different character, Jim Bonnick, who Magnum thinks is Mac. And he continues to be called Mac, even though Magnum eventually learns that he is not Mac. He's just this con man who gets into all sorts of trouble and ropes everyone into it. The show was also known for having a great number of guest stars who were not famous at that point, but who would go on to be famous. Which guest stars were the best? Here's Metagirl with another top five list.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I'm back, retro fans, bringing you another top five list for Magnum PI. This is one of my favorite TV shows, so I couldn't stop at just one. And now, the top five guest stars appearing on the television series Magnum PI. At number 5 is Jimmy Doohan. That's right, Scotty from Star Trek beamed aboard Magnum to play Archie McPherson in the episode Big Blow. Number 4 is Angela Lansbury, playing her famous character Jessica Fletcher from Murder, She Wrote in the episode Novel Connection. What a crossover! At number 3 is Carol Burnett, who played Susan Johnson in the episodes A Girl Named Sue and Rembrandt's Girl. Number 2 is Frank Sinatra, who played retired police sergeant Michael Doheny in the episode Laura. And the number 1 guest star on Magnum PI is Orson Welles, who though is never seen in the show, was the recurring mysterious voice of Robin Masters. And there you have it, the Retroist's top 5 guest stars on the television series Magnum PI. Until next time, list fans, this has been Metagirl.
Thanks, Metagirl. The show premiered on December 11, 1980, and was an instant hit. You had the likable Tom Selleck playing Magnum, who not only was a good actor, but was pretty easy on the eyes. And that played very much into the success of the show early on. You had the beautiful backdrop of Hawaii, great guest stars, solid writing. In the first 5 seasons, the show would finish in the top 20 of U.S. television programs and was one of the highest rated shows on Thursday nights until 1984 rolled around. And then a little show called The Cosby Show premiered opposite Magnum. Now that show would eventually become the number 1 show and would continually outrank Magnum PI. So the show was still doing well when they decided that they would end it in the 7th season and call it quits. But when they did something that annoyed me and a lot of other fans. They would kill off Magnum, which was intended to end the series. Needless to say, the fans at the time freaked out, and it was a large outcry. And so an 8th and final season was produced that brought Magnum back to life and ended the series in a way that was much more appealing to fans. This allowed CBS to run these really great seance commercials with the remaining live cast members. And let's give a listen to one of those.
It's a lot of mumbo-jumbo.
He's right, Higgin. You've gone too far.
In the Burma campaign, a seance was quite successful in receiving important instructions from our departed colonel.
But Thomas is gone.
He's history.
I think you'll find that it's not entirely accurate.
Thomas?
Thomas? That you?
This would, of course, open the door for future Magnum projects. The studios thought it had appeal and would actually hire the writer Tom Clancy to come up with a script with Magnum returning to the Navy, and then it would be his subsequent adventures there. They would rework it, do a lot more research, but Universal ultimately passed on the script, saying it wouldn't be a big box office draw. And I can understand why they passed, because the charm of Magnum was the laid-back setting, and to disconnect Magnum from Hawaii just seemed pointless. It would also be hard to hit on the comic elements that are very popular in the show. Now, I printed out my local paper from 1980 to look at what was on the night Magnum PI premiered. So let's take a look at that. Magnum PI would premiere at 8 p.m., and it had a two-hour premiere that Thursday night, running from 8 till 10 on CBS, which in my area was Channel 2. Against it was Games People Play on NBC, which is a reality show that features events. For example, highlights include a world record distance car jump attempt, a martial arts demonstration, a cops versus cons football game, that sort of thing. Most memorably in this one is the toughest bouncer competition, which I think Mr. T was a part of at that point, or at least was mentioned in it. On Channel 5, which was a local station that eventually would become Fox, they were showing PM Magazine and the Merv Griffin Show. On ABC, you had Mork and Mindy on at 8. 8:30 was Bosom Buddies. 9 o'clock was Barney Miller. And 9:30 was It's a Living. It's a pretty good night of television. Channel 9, WOR, you have a basketball game, the Knicks versus the Bucks. Channel 11, WPIX, another local station, up against Magnum, the Rockford Files from 8 to 9, followed by Solid Gold from 9 to 10. So some pretty good options, although I think Magnum is the right thing to watch. But if I look at HBO, which is in my local paper, which is amazing, it's 1980 and they're putting HBO in the listing. It's the only cable channel that's there. They're showing The Muppet Movie at 8:30. That's a pretty good movie. Now, I often don't look at the UHF stations in the listing, but they're showing movies that night, and they're showing The Rose on a UHF station in my area, Channel 68, which I used to love Channel 68. They would show Uncle Floyd, they would show Mr. Ed, lots of old television during the day when the reception was strong. So this is in December, so it's kind of fun to look at the paper. There's the Christmas listings for Abraham and Strauss. It's a department store in my area. They're selling some nice audio equipment. A Fisher six-piece hi-fi audio system for just $499. Ooh, an Amana touch control radar range. So much metal on this thing. $429. One of my favorite stores growing up, Two Guys, was having a three-day Christmas sale. Lots of fun clothing from the early 80s. They're also selling cigars and tomato sauce. Oh, and Walt Disney sculptured soap. So if you wanted a Mickey or Donald-shaped soap, this is the place you go. It was obviously kind of to compete with Soap on a Rope, which is also listed here. That's why I love Two Guys. A place we used to go a lot was a kind of a early big box store called Valley Fair. And what I loved about Valley Fair was they had a great toy section and a great pet store section. So many fish and birds. But they have a Valley Fair ad here, which just reminds me of why I liked it. Toys are front and center. Simon, Othello, the magical musical thing, which I've written about, the Mickey Mouse talking toothbrush, the perfume maker set. That's fun. To make your own perfumes. That must have quickly smelled bad. And then they had a bunch of Mattel electronics, soccer, football, basketball. Two more things. They're having these events at stores, a night for men only at women's clothing stores. Select a fashion gift for the woman in your life. We've set aside a special night for your holiday shopping. Men's night includes free gift boxing, personalized and courteous service. Shop at leisure. Refreshments will be served. I guess this was pretty common at the time, where they would try to appeal to men around the shopping season to get them to come into women's stores to buy clothing for the women in their life. And finally, the Video Center in Fairlawn, New Jersey. They're advertising what they're selling, giant screen TV, the Advent Video Beam, which is a kind of big deal. But more importantly, if you go there, you could meet Klaatu, the computerized humanoid talking robot who will amaze and entertain young and old alike. There's a great little illustration of Klaatu in the shot. I wish I had gone to meet Klaatu. I just want to end on an unfortunate note. My local reviewer, Dan Lewis, writing about Magnum PI is very negative. He just doesn't get it. The title is New Hawaiian Show Debuts as CBS Tries to Fill 5-0 Shoes. And I think the last sentence summarized what he thinks. In a season already marked by a crop of unappealing new shows, Magnum PI continues the unfortunate trend. Boo, Dan Lewis. Boo, you got it all wrong. The show has great theme music. Originally, the opening credits was this jazzy piece by Ian Freeburn Smith, which would be used not only in the pilot, but the first 9 episodes of the show. Then, beginning in episode 12, it was replaced by something that's a bit more familiar. You might know it. It goes a little like this.
Up a notch to number 36, Mike Post, and the theme from Magnum PI.
That piece was done by Mike Post and Pete Carpenter with Larry Carlton on guitar. A longer version of this theme, credited to Post, was released as a single by Elektra Records, capitalizing on the success of Magnum, and was featured on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, peaking at number 12 on May 8, 1982. This would also appear on Post's 1982 album, Television Theme Songs. There was some crossovers with other shows with Magnum P.I. So there is a shared universe. In the episode Keys Don't Lie, there's a crossover with Simon and Simon. And then in novel Connection, Jessica Fletcher from Murder, She Wrote comes to Hawaii. And that would end on Murder, She Wrote's episode Magnum on Ice. There was an attempt at an Equalizer crossover that never happened. And most interestingly, after Magnum P.I. was over, there was going to be a Quantum Leap crossover, potentially, where Dr. Beckett would leap into Magnum P.I. While we don't know much about the details, it does appear that they did shoot some test footage with Scott Bakula from Quantum Leap in the role. That would have been amazing to happen, but sadly never did. All 8 seasons of the show were released on DVD in 2013. While there are a lot of fans of this show who would love to see a Blu-ray release, we did not get an American Blu-ray release, but they did release one in the United Kingdom, where the complete series was released on HD, and fans of the show were forced to import it from there. The show did win some awards and was nominated for many, including several Golden Globe Awards. Hillerman would win in 1982 for Best Supporting Actor, and Selleck would win in 1985 for Best Actor on a Television Series Drama. For Emmys, it would also score a lot of nominations and 2 wins. In 84, Selleck would win for Lead Actor, and Hillerman would win in 87 for Best Supporting Actor in a Drama Series. In October of 2017, they announced that there was going to be a new Magnum P.I. Now, before this, there had been talk of doing a continuation of the original or a TV movie based on the original, and I kept hoping that would happen, but they brought this new Magnum P.I. played by Jay Hernandez, who is good. The entire cast is really solid. Now, although the plot is similar, there are some differences in it, and it's more modern, but it is nice that they keep the idea of Magnum P.I. alive. What I don't love is when a new show comes on and you do a search for the old one, you're still getting the new one, even though the old one was probably a lot more popular than the new one. Just so happens they favor more modern things. While Magnum P.I. on its surface appears to be a story about a detective, some people have read more deeply into the show, and that the show is about a group of ex-soldiers who haven't been able to get over their past, and they live in this paradise. Some have even said that they have passed away and they're in this paradise, and that the actions they're taking by confronting their past are seeking to make amends or find redemption. You could almost see this paradise as a purgatory, where they're trying to resolve their earthly issues and live in this liminal space between life and death. And Magnum is often mentioning paradise. The thing about paradise is frequently how he begins an episode in his narration. Not saying Hawaii. There's definitely an emphasis on unfinished business in a lot of episodes. Almost more importantly, this idea of looking at the past and not being able to let go. I think that's best represented in the episode Black on White, where there is this Tomytronic portable Pac-Man game in it. And in the episode, we get a rare glimpse of Higgins's life before the show. And we see that it wasn't all rosy for Higgins. Terrible things happened. And throughout the show, the Pac-Man game is being played. There's this idea of chasing ghosts, something that you do in Pac-Man. And Magnum's pretty good at it. And maybe these ghosts are about deeper buried trauma and emotion. We know Magnum is constantly wrestling with his past, but Higgins, with his stiff upper lip attitude, he often seems immune to the trials and tribulations of an entire life spent at war, much longer than Magnum. And the game becomes a metaphor for those internal struggles. And in the final scene, we see Higgins and learn that he is incredibly accomplished at chasing ghosts. We see that in the game, and when he says it, it takes on a deeper meaning. And let's play a little bit of that.
The islands have a way of easing pain, of helping one forget the past, which is probably why I'm here. But I had the feeling that no matter how warm the sand or how blue the sky, part of me would never forget Private Edwin Clutterbuck. I don't recall who said war is hell, but whoever it was, he was only half right. It isn't just war that's hell. It's living with the memories of what you didn't.
Higgins always radiates this sort of buried emotion, but here the writers of the show are teasing us with just how profound those emotions might be. Maybe he is also locked into this world with Magnum and TC and Rick, existing in a paradise for reasons that we might not know. If we do look at the show that way, it kind of puts it under a more thought-provoking lens in which to view the series and elevates it from a lighthearted detective series to a more profound commentary on life, death, and what might be beyond. Or maybe it's just a really fun detective show. Thanks for listening to the show. For more retro fun, you can drop by the website at retroist.com. If you want to follow me on social media, I'm at most of the major social media sites at Retroist. The music you hear on the show is by Peachy. If you like what you hear, you should follow Peachy on Twitter and Twitch. He's at PeachyPixel8. That's the word Peachy, the word pixel, and the number 8. Thanks to Metagirl for another great top 5 list. If you like what you hear, you should follow Metagirl on Twitter. She's at Metagirl. That's MATAGRRL. If you'd like to support the show, you could do so by giving it a 5-star review wherever you downloaded the show. It really is only the 5-star reviews that help people find this show, and if you had the time to do so, I really would appreciate it. If you'd like to support the show further, The Retroist is on Patreon. For just a couple of bucks a month, you get bonus episodes, bonus tracks, bonus scans, and access to The Retroist Discord, the greatest retro community on the internet. This is part of an ongoing series where I revisit older episodes of the show, try to add to them, and re-record them. I hope you enjoy it. I have some other ones I plan on doing, and if you have any suggestions of ones you'd like to hear, let me know. Thanks for listening to the show, and I hope you have a great weekend.
Magnum. This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.